Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of occupied America.
You're welcome to another Signs of the Times podcast. This is our final podcast of 2005. And rather than do the standard look back at the year and yearly roundup, we've decided just to ignore all that and to do something completely different. This week we have a guest, and since we're in France, we decided it was about time that we had a French guest. With us tonight is Pierre, who is from Marseille and is interested in the Cassiopeia material and the various other aspects of the Cassiopeia site. And we thought we would just have him on the show tonight to talk a little bit about things that he knows about. And you're going to find out exactly what they are throughout the course of the next half hour or so. So, Pierre, you're very welcome to our end of year podcast.
We'd like to thank you for coming in and subjecting yourself to this.
Yes. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks all, and thanks to the Quantum Future Group for your interest and for welcoming me tonight. Well, I'm French. I'm 33 years old. I first studied engineering and then management. Currently, I'm working as a manager, management position. I have some hobbies like sport, nature, and all what we call now esotericism. I'm born in Toulouse, and I'm currently living in Marseille, southern France.
And how did you first find the Cassiopeia websites?
I discovered the Cassiopeian website, say, 4 or 5 years ago. I've always had a strong interest in, how can we call that, hidden things or invisible things. So I went through Buddhism, Taoism, Freemasonry, all those schools where you can touch or reach the invisible. And along this quest, through books, chats, and internet research, I finally found this Cassiopeian website.
So you were a Mason?
Most Masons, where they are, they say they're not, and when they are not, they say they are.
We'll never get a straight answer. Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, I've been and I stopped, and that's not the place where I found the answers to my questions. Definitely, mm-hmm. But it was an interesting experience. And
did you learn how to build anything? Like a house or a wall or something?
Or Solomon Temple?
Yeah,
nothing like that.
You didn't make it up to the 33rd degree.
Yeah, that's where you learn how to build your own house, you know, for like $10 or something. That's the deep secret. Because, I mean, they're Masons, right? I mean, yeah. there's got to be some aspect to, like, you know, putting mm-hmm. bricks and mortar together, right?
Using old copies of Dogma and Morals as building materials.
I've built a house with 33 levels in it.
Uh-huh.
So it's a pretty big house.
Yeah. Okay, so we understand that when Ark and Laura were in Marseille a few months back, which the pictures from that trip actually can be seen as a link on the Signs website, we understand that you offered to take Laura to see a historic site, which we know that she's talked a little bit about to us anyway. But what exactly was that site, and can you give some details about it?
In Marseille, there is one big dominant church called Notre-Dame de la Garde, where every tourist goes. And there is another less famous church called Saint-Victor Church. I think it's an interesting building because of different reasons. First of all, it's a very old church. It might be the oldest Christian church in Western Europe. It was built in the 4th century after death. Second, it's dedicated to Saint-Victor, who is one of the saints who slayed dragons, like Saint-Michel, Saint-Marcel, or Saint-Georges. Saint-Victor was built by Saint-Cassien. Saint-Cassien, who came from Bulgaria, where the Bogomils developed in the 9th century after death. And in the foundations of Saint-Victor, you have a black virgin with an infant. And I find quite in this Black Virgin tradition quite interesting, because it may be a kind of link from Egypt goddess Isis, Mary Magdalena, and Black Virgins. And last thing is that Saint Cassien, you find the same root as Cassiopeia, is the one who built Lumini Historic Building and Centerbaum Building. And Centerbaum is believed to be the place where Maria Magdalena had her hermitage after reaching France.
And, of course, Mary Magdalena, for those of you that have read the infamous Da Vinci Code, is the woman who is purported to be the consort or the spouse of Jesus. We don't believe that for a minute because we think it was somebody else, but we'll talk about that another time. But there are many stories of Marie Magdalene coming to France after the death of Jesus. And for those of you who don't know...
The alleged death of Jesus.
The alleged death of Jesus. That she lived around Marseille, and there's a cave, if I'm not...
That's right.
There's
a cave in this mountain called Sainte-Baume. It's funny because Baume means balm in English, and that there's a mention of balm used between Maria Magdalena and Jesus Christ in the Bible.
Yeah, the alabaster jar. Right?
Mm-hmm. I share the same diagnostic as you, as far as Jesus Christ dynamics is concerned.
And we were talking earlier, I think you said that Saint Cassien was... Are the tarot cards of Marseille attributed to him as well?
Yeah, indeed. Saint Cassien is believed to be the one who introduced tarot cards, what we call a genuine one, called Marseille tarot cards. And apparently Saint Cassien, along his way, has been living in eastern countries and maybe brought back some knowledge from those places. Materialized within tarot symbols.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Saint Cassien and the Bogomils. One of the topics we wanted to get onto with you was the subject of the Cathars. And the Cathars, for those of you who don't know, were a Christian group that flourished in the 11th and 12th centuries before the church set out to kill them all off. With a crusade in the south of France, they were linked or their origins are tied to the Bogomils. Could you talk about that a bit?
Oh, I don't have concrete proofs about the links between Bogomils and Cathars, but what we can see is all over centuries from the 4th century until Cathars and even later, you can perceive all around Mediterranean Sea a dualist tradition. I mean, a dualist way of seeing the world.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could enlighten our listeners as to what the dualist tradition is.
I hope I will enlighten listeners. More probably, I will give some information about dualism. Dualism is a paradigm, philosophy, religion, where there would be, say, two worlds, one material world, that is a world of suffering, of impermanence, of... fights and rules and dominations and struggles or wars, and another that is the material war that according to Cathars is ruled by the bad god, say Satan, and there is also another world that is the good world, that is an invisible world that is ruled by the good god. But this tradition is long lasting and widespread. You can find it in Mithraism, in Zoroastrianism, Manes, Mani, widespread this vision of the world, Bogomiles too, and later on Cathars.
It's one of those themes that keeps re-emerging, and in the work that we've done, and especially Laura, you see that there is kind of subterranean teaching that keeps sprouting from time to time throughout history, and the dualism seems to be one of the fundamental ideas in this subterranean teaching. In esoteric Christianity, it gets expressed in the ideas of the absolute one, two, and three, where the absolute three is this world that we're in now, and the absolute two would be the world of Christ, the world into which we could be born if that which has to be done before a certain time gets accomplished.
Yeah. There's a lot of connections between Mouravieff works and Cathar philosophy. you mentioned church, the Roman church, and actually in 11th, 12th, and 13th century, there were, in a sense, two churches coexisting. There was the official Roman church.
And we should say this is in the West, because in the East, the Orthodox Church was in existence, and by the 11th century, there'd been the split between the Roman Church and the Orthodox Church.
Indeed. In southern France, you had two coexisting churches, the dominating and fierce church and a small and forgiving one.
And it had a great influence on the culture in the Languedoc at the time.
Catharism was widespread all along French Mediterranean coast, reaching some northern Italian territory and northeastern Spanish territories, known as Catalonia now. And it became a highly widespread religion, and therefore having major influence on cultural dimension, way of life, relationship with others, with notions of good and bad, and a way of seeing the life and the world.
Languedoc, in that time, it was a flowering of culture. You had the troubadours and all that, and all that is very closely related to the Cathars. There was a culture and an environment that was much different from that in Northern Europe or, elsewhere.
Actually, it shows that, I mean, probably the ideas you have in your ear, as we say in French, is that religious environment has a strong impact on non-religious environment, like cultural, economic. The official Roman Church and Cathar Church were coexisting. But I think that fundamentally the teaching of Cathar religion were highly widespread, and this way of seeing the world had a strong impact on economic, cultural, and social life. And that's why in 11th and 12th century, Languedoc, southern France, was one of the most developed region in the Western world. At the same time, Roman Church that was spreading different dogmas, different vision of the world, led to a kind of underdeveloping world.
And we certainly see that continuing today with the effects of the Catholic Church.
Certainly.
I know that in the Cathar Church and in the south of France in that time, the role of women was very different than it was elsewhere. Could you talk a bit about that?
Behind purely religious dogmas, like true nature of Christ or true nature of God, and all those conciles contents, Cathar religion was carrying a specific vision of society. For example, there was not a strong hierarchy, as you can see in some other religious organization, and there was no differentiation between men and women. Why? Because of this dualist vision of human beings. Human beings are made of one first component, coming from the bad world, that is the flesh, that is the body and the brain, and a second component that we could call that's the remains of the fallen angel, the soul. And women and men come from this same world. So they are fundamentally equal, even if their material envelope is slightly different.
And the material envelope is impermanent and will leave, and what remains will be the permanent soul, which is identical between the two.
Obviously, and the Cathars, they believed in reincarnation. I mean, the idea that, that obviously a strong belief in reincarnation would kind of preclude any prejudice against one sex or the other if you know that, you can be one or other in any future life or past life,
Yeah, it's true. At the same time, I can imagine some vicious religion believing in reincarnation and thinking that if you're not good, you will become a woman. And if you're not good at all, you'll become an animal.
There's infinite ways to twist it,
At the same time, it's seven centuries after the end of the official end of Catharism, and this religion has been erased, almost totally destroyed. So it's difficult to to talk with certainty about Catharism.
Yeah, because there are very few original documents of their rituals, if you could call them that, of their prayers or what their religion or philosophy was.
Indeed, at the same time, I think it would be a mistake to perceive Catharism as a monolithic religion.
True.
There was this, I think, this specific way of dealing with free will that led to highly diverse religious movement, respecting, in a sense, the will and way of seeing the world of each of the community member. As far as Cathar documents are concerned, one of the main reference was the New Gospel, and more specifically the St. John Gospel, that is, in a sense, the source of all heresies. Because of this sentence, my kingdom is not from this world, that gives legitimacy to another world, to a non-manifested, a non-tangible, mm-hmm. non-material world that would be the real world. Mm-hmm. And Catharism is strongly based on the content of New Gospel, but with slightly, or sometimes fundamentally different interpretations.
Mm. So we've stated that that you were attracted or interested in the Cassiopeian material, the Cassiopeian philosophy. What in the Cassiopeian philosophy did you see that, if anything, that is comparative to or comparable to the philosophy of the Cathars, the kind of philosophy that you've just described?
I mean, there's a lot of material in Cassiopeian philosophy. One strong analogy I can perceive between Catharism and Cassiopeian philosophy is this dualistic vision of the world. I mean, there are incarnated human beings living in a material world, impermanent world, and there is something beyond that. Our quest, in a sense, is to discover what is behind the mirror, what is behind this material, tangible world. I think that Cathar were in this paradigm.
And there are two paths. There's a path towards this other world, the invisible world, and there's a path towards the material. One is towards creativity and one is towards entropy.
What you say is very true. But I don't know to which extent Cathar formalized that.
I don't know either, because from what I've read of the Cathars, it wasn't as explicit. And the trouble there is there are very few remaining Cathar texts, and much of what we get about them and about their beliefs come from the documents of the Inquisition. And as we know from recent events, confessions and information gotten under torture are not necessarily the most reliable.
Indeed. Indeed, we can suspect that there were some content relating to importance of free will, entropy versus creativity, importance of knowledge, because you can judge the tree through its fruits, and the fruits of this Cathar culture, Cathar community, were brilliant, were beautiful. Mm-hmm. So you can assume that Cathar had been dealing with those concepts. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any proof, any written text, any tangible material proving interactions between Cathar and those concepts.
One of the differences that I've read about between the north of France and the south of France in that period was, in the north of France, the heritage of land and wealth always went to the eldest son, whereas in the south, they tended to divide land, property, and wealth among all of the children, which is a much more just way of doing things. And that created social conditions in the south that were very, very different from that in the north, because you didn't get the ensconced positions of power that were reinforced generation after generation. You had divisions. So the society seemed to have been much more equitable. And also the difference between the rulers, if you will, and the rest of the population would have been much different than that was found in the north of the country.
Yeah, I think that redistributing ground is an excellent way to fight against entropy. You change power structures. You redistribute opportunities to opportunities to for creation.
Indeed.
Another difference is language. Languedoc comes from Languedoc, language, by opposition to Languedoy. That was the language that was spoken in northern territories. I mean, French northern territories.
The we and the oc.
Yeah, exactly. Oi and oc. That means yes in those two languages. And we also can imagine that Catharism represented a major threat, because finally Philippe le Bel, the king of the Franks at this time, France didn't really exist, but the, Philippe le Bel organized a crusade, not in Jerusalem, but in what is now France, in what is now southern France. And for over 40 years, soldiers from Languedoc, speaking Languedoc, from Languedoc, fighted in Languedoc and killed something like 100,000 people over 40 years, torturing, burning village, killing men, women, and kids.
Oh, we should say that there were also Cathars in the north of France and in Germany as well, so it wasn't limited. This was a teaching and a belief that was fairly widespread, but there were smaller pockets, as I understand it, in the north.
In Cologne, for example, in Toscane, we talked about it, Italia, and of course after the relative destruction of Catharism in France, the Cathars survived, widespread a bit everywhere, including northern France.
It seems to me, and I'm just kind of hypothesizing here, because as you say, there's very little known about the Cathars in terms of what they actually did or believed, or there's, as you say, there's no texts or very few texts detailing their lives and their beliefs. But it seems to me, as Henry said, that throughout the course of history, or recorded history, that there were groups that sprung up every so often that seemed to have a... And how they formed together is we can only guess at, but that there were a group of people who had a common ideal and a common view or vision of what life was about and the way to live life. And there's another example, just when you're talking about the kind of laws... that governed kind of what we know of the laws that govern Catholic society. There was maybe 1,000 years before that in parts of Europe, in Ireland, for example, there was under the kind of pre-Christian Celtic kind of societies, there were laws, you know, kind of similar laws that were organized in a much more equitable way. And was sure there was a chief or a guy who was kind of appointed or elected to be the leader, but in terms of how the community functioned, it was not a matter of him basically controlling everyone else, but that they saw themselves as a unit and had, as I say, very different and a very different view of how to live than people do today or have done for a long time. And the other notable thing is that these systems or these ways of life that spring up are usually very quickly or quite quickly destroyed by some other force. In the case of the Cathars, it was the Catholic Church, obviously. And it's interesting to me that, you know, the Catholic Church has apologized for all of its kind of transgressions in the past, in terms of the Crusades and the Inquisition and the massacring of thousands of people, including the Cathars. But as I see it, there's very little in terms of ideology. There's very little has changed. Okay, the Catholic Church doesn't have armies anymore to go and massacre people, but in terms of ideology, the Catholic Church isn't very much different from the Catholic Church that massacred the Cathars.
I'm afraid you're right about analogies between Celtic culture, Celtic religions, and Cathar religions. We can see that in Cathar religion, keeping in mind the role of woman, this high diversity, this very low level of hierarchy in this religious organization, that Cathar is more likely to be part of the circle civilization than part of the triangle civilization. In the beginning of our discussion, we were talking about Jesus Christ and his death. By the way, Katha thought that Jesus Christ didn't die on the cross, maybe for different reasons. Since they were monophysite, they thought Jesus Christ didn't have a double nature, mm-hmm. as the Roman Church said in Nicene Concile. For Katha, Jesus Christ was definitely from the good world, so mm-hmm. from divine nature. So, consequently, he couldn't die on the cross or somewhere else.
And for them, the cross was not a symbol that they honored. I think almost to the contrary, they saw it as a symbol of all that was wrong with the Catholic Church, the Roman Church.
It can relate to the to this myth or non-myth of Templars spitting on cross. But if you take some distance, cross is fundamentally a torture tool. I could imagine some very evil modern cult having as a main symbol a Kalashnikov. I would allow myself to spit on a Kalashnikov. I don't think I would be a Satanist because I spit on a Kalashnikov. People at this time could have the same interpretation for the torture tool that is a cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, on the symbolism of taking someone, if we take the idea that that Jesus didn't die on the cross or wasn't crucified, if you take that idea to be true, then it is pretty dastardly for the later Catholic Church or the early Catholic Church or the early Roman Church to concoct this kind of story and to take someone that they obviously knew was someone of great importance in terms of the teachings that he taught or the lessons that he taught to people or the information he had to share. They took that person and they essentially nailed him to a cross and then established that as the as a symbol of the religion that people who initially maybe had followed Jesus and knew exactly what he was and what he was teaching. I mean, it just seems like a really evil thing to do, and certainly in terms of the symbolism.
The dead man on the stick.
Yeah, they wanted to destroy the teachings in a very blatant symbolic way. They did it, you know, by nailing him to the cross.
Katha might think that it's normal to notice evil thing that happens in the world ruled by evil, the bad god. It's perfectly consistent. Katha had a paternoster, like a Christian. I mean, like a regular...
That's the Our Father.
Mm-hmm. Our Father, paternoster in Latin. That is almost exactly the same as the Roman church. Pater Noster, except one sentence about this daily bread, where it said, Panem Nostrum super substantialem da nobis hodie. That means give us our super substantial bread. And that's a major difference with the classical Pater Noster. Obviously, Jesus Christ teaching, symbolized by bread, has an influence on say spiritual dimension of human beings.
Yeah, well, it's something that the people who invented the Catholic religion did in general with the teachings of Jesus, in that they took everything that was taught in a spiritual way. They took spiritual concepts and made them completely physical. You know, I mean, the very idea of putting Jesus on a cross corrupted the idea of his teachings of suffering. Suffering for an ideal, and they made it all completely physical, and say that, you know, he suffered and died, and not only that, but kind of we killed him, you know, or the people killed him. People killed their own kind of savior, and obviously they created the whole saviorship as well. But in the same way, in this Cathar version of the,
and this crucifixion thing was a kind of major move backwards, because I think Jesus Christ was opening the era of. That was transcending this notion of sacrifice. And in a sense, crucifixion was kind of mixing up again this suffering and sacrifice and salvation. However, as we say often, it's not Jesus Christ who made Christianism, it's Christianism who made Jesus Christ. and who wrote the official story.
Mm-hmm.
And this time again, winners wrote the story and wrote the story of Jesus Christ.
Let's be clear that when we're talking about suffering in what we understand as being the real teachings of Jesus, it's the suffering of becoming the master of oneself. There's a suffering of being in this material world and trying to attain a contact with the real self that is there but that is hidden by all these layers of false selves that we have, our ideas about ourselves, the false personality that we have. And the real suffering is the work that you do to try to align each of these little selves with your real self so that you can reach it in some sort of permanent way.
Your worlds are kind of syncretizing Buddhism, Catharism, and Mohrafev teaching, for example. Yes, probably the quest for human beings is this quest for transcending egos and the different personalities, different aspects of egos in order to reach and discover the real self, what we call awakening.
Well, that about wraps it up for this week's podcast. We want to thank Pierre for joining us today. And as always, if you would like to find more information on the topics we discussed today, you can read the articles at www.signs-of-the-times.org. And have a happy new year, and we'll see you next year.